a legend. This is completely...
Have you been to Black Barrow, Ambassador?
His blue eyes look troubled.
Black Barrow is the only place where, once killed, the Krall can't be raised again. It's the only place we can fight them with any hope of winning.
So you want us to help you invade your neighbor? That's an awfully bold interpretation of accords intended to curtail the Chantry's imperial ambitions.
Suddenly, from many stories below, the speaker felt an unfamiliar magic. Though she'd only met a half-dozen magi and had never seen them use their talents, she knew instantly that this was a magus in her Chantry.
Speaker, is something wrong?
Estariel had only moments to decide how to react. Could she turn the presence of a hostile mage to her advantage? Would interrupting the meeting be to her advantage? Perhaps it could have been if the Chantry's objective in this talk were anything positive. As it was, she wished only to back out of a centuries-old treaty without declaring war.
Yes, you slap us in the face with old, unfounded allegations, sir. We wish only to survive as a house of learning.
A rush of magic much more powerful to her snapped in response to the intruder, whoever he was. Estariel was surprised at the force of it. It was a chaining magic, and the only magi she could imagine powerful enough to use it was Ariel. Blessed Oblivious Ariel. Or, perhaps, Fi.
A house of learning. Does that include learning battle magic?
If our allies abandon us in the face of a massacre, yes.
This is most precipitous.
Estariel opened her mouth to deliver a historical reminder when a magical concussion ripped through the Chantry. The constant buzz of Magi's talents ceased, and for the first time in centuries, perhaps the first time since it was built, the Chantry was utterly silent. The magic ripped through everything, though it destroyed nothing except whatever the sisters were actively weaving. It had character, a distinct flavor, free and fierce, not hostile, but rather a strength unaware of itself. The impossible image that leapt to Estariel's mind was of a teenage archmage, and it shook her to her core. Ariel had tried to chain him, and he refused to be chained. Magically, Estariel felt like a little girl trapped between screaming parents.
What was that?
By the Seraph. It was powerful enough even this untalented toad could feel it.
We hereby withdraw from the Accords, Ambassador. If Aliterra wishes to expel the Magi from its dominions, they will leave peacefully. I do request, however, that you give us 6 months to show our good faith. This is no declaration of war with you. Please, let the Emperor know that we fight only to live.
The King always thought you were one of the Chantry's more moderate voices, Estariel. Surely the discussions needn't end on this. You wouldn't throw away hundreds of years of cooperation and progress.
The Archmage was climbing the Chantry, getting ever closer. He'd used so much magic that he still burned with it. Estariel could almost see him through the floor. She didn't want to have this conversation now, but she couldn't exactly throw the ambassador out.
No, I don't wish to throw away anything, least of all our lives. Perhaps this fall I can come to Skaun and meet with the Emperor personally.
It wasn't some random Archmage, Estariel realized. It was V's damned husband. What the hell was he doing? Was V attempting a coup? No, that made no sense. Leading a coup with a man? Even sisters with dual loyalties would automatically side against him. So it was something else entirely. That scared the hell out of her.
Perhaps we could conclude this conversation later this afternoon.
Your pardon, Speaker, but I can't imagine there's really anything more important than the dissolution or defense of an alliance 300 years old. I must insist we finish.
Speaker Estariel sat back down at her desk and gathered her talent to her, facing the door. He was almost here. A young man with his face set fiercely stepped in.
Arcanus Magnus!
Estariel unleashed a massive fist of air. It turned aside in midair and smashed a collection of thousand-year-old Hyrillic vases.
Arcanus Magnus!
She lashed out again and punched a hole in the ceiling. Impervious, almost oblivious to her attempts to kill him, Kyler strode to her desk, put his hands on it, and leaned forward. She gathered her full strength. He blew in her face. Her talons scattered as if that puff had been a hurricane. He said nothing. He looked into her eyes, and deep within his eyes was something that made her want to gibber like a madwoman. It was like staring at the night sky after learning for the first time that the stars were not pinpricks in the raiment of heaven, but each its own sun, billions of leagues distant. To stare into this man's eyes was to realize how small one was. Kyla was not finding what he wanted. The Alateran ambassador, either finding his courage or seeing no magic springing from the young man, stood.
I dare say, you young lout, I'm not going to let you disrespect any woman while I stand by. Stand and deliver, sir!
We'll talk about respecting women when you stop fucking your wife's best friend.
The ambassador's hauteur shattered. Kyla turned on his heel and walked out. Istariel and the ambassador said nothing for a full minute.
Perhaps we can agree that nothing of this leaves the room.
He swallowed and nodded. V was up here somewhere. Kyler's encounter with the speaker had left him shaken. He'd been sure that she'd stolen retribution. One look in her eyes told him otherwise. Now, what had looked like an unexpected move that would bring him to the center of the deceiver's web and deliver his sword back into his hand was looking like a colossal blunder. Nonetheless, Kyla bowled forward. He was committed now. The floors this high in the chantry weren't large. The Seraph's head held the speaker's office, a waiting room, some storerooms, the stairs, and a classroom. In that classroom was B. Kyler opened the door to the last room before the classroom. He'd kicked down enough doors. This room was at the Seraph's eyes. It was a broad, open room, but despite the light pouring in from the glass-clear eyes, it had a distinctly unused feeling, as if no one had set foot here in decades. In the center of the room stood a woman, wreathed in light. Her arms were crossed over her chest, chin pointed at the floor, eyes closed. She wore a short gossamer robe that ended at her knees. Halfway down her shins, her skin changed from a shade too golden to be merely sun-kissed to the purest white alabaster. As Kyler stood, stunned by this unexpected beauty, he saw the alabaster recede to her ankles, to her toes. Her chin lifted. She opened her eyes. The irises were pure platinum.
You're the Seraph.
Indeed. And you are a man. And you have awakened me. But you are not the one.
Sorry?
The Seraph stared at him, and as he met those platinum eyes, all he could see was magic, oceanic, and mercifully at rest.
Are you going to do something bad to me now?
Should I? You frightened my little sisters badly, except for the one who holds your bond. I'll leave you to her tender mercies, nameless.
I like that dress better than the one your statue wears. You've got great legs.
Her eyes widened, but he saw that she wasn't displeased.
Me too. But when one is 300 feet tall, it behooves one to err on the side of modesty.
I can't believe I said that.
She arched an eyebrow at him.
Lady? Ma'am? Sorry, what should I call you?
Impertinence suits you better, Nameless. Ask your question.
I lost a sword. I thought the speaker stole it, but I was wrong. Can you tell me if one of the other sisters stole it?
You assume friendship quickly. I can't decide if that's a function of youth or naivete or goodness or your singular powers. Not everyone can weigh a soul in a glance, Nameless.
Sorry for the presumption, my lady.
Give me your sword hand.
He extended his hand and she studied the palm. He saw magic swirling over it.
It's been 3 months since I...
The magic died suddenly. The Seraph's eyes snapped up from his palm to his eyes, and in her platinum eyes, Kyla saw fear.
You fool! Do you have any idea what you've done?
Between the intensity of her tone and her fear, Kyla felt a snake of terror twisting in his guts. What could make the Seraph afraid?
I lost my sword, Retribution. It was my birthright.
Retribution? Was that a Kayla's attempt at a joke?
Kyla said nothing. What had he revealed here? She told him he was naive to trust her. How much did she know now?
I don't know what you're talking about. It's a simple sword inscribed with the word either justice or mercy.
And it depends on you to dispense whichever is deserved.
Well, yeah.
I don't suppose that reminds you of anything? You see the state of souls. You mete out justice or mercy, giving people what they deserve. What does that make you?
A judge.
And a judge decides the application of what?
The law.
Together, Jorsen Alcestis and Ezra created two artifacts. Korok, the Sword of Power, and Iurs, the Scepter of Law.
But it's supposed to be
He'd seen Korok shift into any shape it needed to be. He'd seen Retribution raise the words mercy or justice in different languages. Why not hide Iurs as a sword? Where better to hide Iurs than with Durzo, whose Kakari concealed him? What better place to keep the Kakari of concealment than concealing one of the greatest artifacts in history? Kyler should have known Durzo wouldn't have retrieved Retribution simply to spare Kyler of the inconvenience of having his swords blunted. How many times had Durzo told him the blade was priceless?
Do you know where it is?
Holding his hand, the Seraph closed her eyes and glowed golden. The light started in her forehead and expanded until it filled the room. For an instant, Kyla swore the entire Seraph, the big one, was aglow. And the woman opened her eyes.
It is in Treathel.
Treathel?
Kyla remembered the name dimly. Achilles Thorn had been the prince of Treathel.
Oh, it's in Black Barrow.
Nameless. The scepter, Iurs, gives a mage no additional power, but it gives 1,000 times the control. A mage with Iurs in hand could unravel anything, given time.
So what was Neff doing? With Iurs, he could take apart the shield around Ezra's wood and take Korok. What would he do once he had both? What would he not do? Even Jorsen Alcestis hadn't wielded both together. There was no choice. Kyler was the judge. If Neff was invulnerable to magic, Kyler was the only one who could stop him. Kyler might be the only one who knew the full extent of the danger. He had to stop him.
God, how am I going to tell Aline?
At the thought of Aline, Kyler felt V flinch through the bond. There was a deep guilt there, and fear. Kyler turned from the Seraph, anger stirring once again. He opened the door to the classroom and strode in. There were 50 senior students in the room, every one of them surrounded with a nimbus of magic. V stood in the center of them. She alone didn't hold her talent.
What have you done?
What have I done? What have you done? Breaking in here and treating my sisters like this. How dare you?
Kyler opened his mouth.
No! Sit down and shut up!
The words hit him like a whip through their earrings bond. The compulsion made Kyler's mouth snap closed, and he sat instantly. There was no chair. He sat on the ground. V was as stunned as he was. He tried to open his mouth, but it wouldn't budge. He couldn't move. V had told him that the rings broke her compulsion to Gareth because its bond superseded Gareth's magic, but Kyler hadn't appreciated what that meant until now. The earrings bond was compulsive, one way. V could make him do anything she wanted, and she had known all along, Kyla saw from her expression. She simply hadn't invoked her power before. The sisters stared round-eyed at V. A moment before, they all had been terrified of this man who had violated the chantry and broken the chains their most powerful sister had laid on him. In the next, V had defended her sisters, and he obeyed her command as if he had no choice. Whatever other repercussions Kyla's foolishness was going to have, he had certainly increased V's cachet with her sisters.
She went to join Logan's army. She was afraid you wouldn't fight otherwise. You can stand now and speak.
Kyla stood and took the note, but he had no words. The door on the far side of the classroom banged open and dozens of sisters began pouring in, with Sister Ariel at their head. Almost all of them, Kylo realized, were magi who'd trained with Vee. One of them threw something like a spear of coruscating red and silver light. It flew straight at Kylo's chest and dissolved in midair. Around the room, sisters began kneeling, mouths dropping once more. Kylo turned to see who had saved him, the Seraph.
I'm sorry if my friend frightened you. Forgive him. We needed to speak about a threat that faces us all. If he fails, all our fighting will be for naught.
The awed sisters parted. With one last glance at Vee, Kylo left.
I won't watch you kill yourself.
For the last 3 days, Kylo and Durzo had been traveling west. Durzo was traveling to Sonaria to see Mama Kay at last, so he joined Kylo. The pass had been muddy and snowy, so they were setting up camp only a few hours from Taurus Bend and a few hundred paces from Ezra's Wood. Kylo spread his heavy saddle blanket on a fallen log next to the fire and sat.
I don't plan to die.
Oh, so there is a plan. I thought you were making it up as you went. It's getting dark. Our little stalker will be along within the hour.
They'd been followed clumsily since they left the Chantry. Today they'd ridden hard trying to make it to Taurus Bend, and their pursuer hadn't been able to keep up.
I don't think Kali exists.
I didn't realize you were in the habit of having religious epiphanies.
I mean, it exists, but I don't think she's a goddess.
Oh?
It is a repository of magic. The wolf said magic is strongest when it's attached to emotions. Kali is filled by the Kalidoran's worship. As they hurt people for her, they chant a prayer. But it's not a prayer, it's a spell. It empties their Glora Virden into the repository. And it's from that repository that the Meisters and Verdmeisters and God Kings draw their power. Because the talents for drawing in magic from the world and using magic are different, that means they can often use far more magic than mages. It means they can use it at night. Don't you see? The entire nation chants this spell twice a day. The repository is the key to Kalidor's power.
And this has something to do with why you're committing suicide?
Kurok is anathema to that power. I saw that when I killed a Meister with it. Kurok makes the Veer explode. It bursts it from within.
A few months ago, you assassinated a man who called himself a god. Now you're going after a goddess in truth. Unless you can figure out a way to kill continents, after this you're going to have to retire.
You know it's not like that.
So you're hoping to find Kali and put Kurok in her and what? Just see what happens?
You make it sound stupid.
You think?
It's a way to win. Really win. Once and for all. Come on now. How many times have you fought Kalidorans?
More than I'd like to remember.
Look. I lost Iurs. That's a disaster. I know it. It's also a disaster you helped cause when you never told me what the damn thing was. With Iurs in Neff's hands, we're going to have a hard time killing him.
We?
But if we destroy the Veer, Neff won't even be able to use Iurs. If he survives the Veer's destruction, even if he has talent, it will take him a while to think to use it. He'll be vulnerable. Master, he's been spending the last 3 months figuring out how to break into Ezra's Wood and take Kurok for himself. If one man holds both Kurok and Iurs...
It wouldn't be good.
It would be a cataclysm!
You realize that if you put Kurok into the center of all the Veer in the world, it might make a qualitative rather than a quantitative difference.
Huh?
Kurok blew the Veer out of one witch and nothing happened. If it blows up all the Veer in the world, something might.
If it blew up every witch in the world, I wouldn't complain.
And if it blows you up with them?
At that point, I won't be able to.
It might not obliterate you. It might just kill you and invoke your immortality. You know what that costs now. Are you willing to risk a friend's life for this? Hell, it might be my life. I don't know if I'm willing for you to risk it.
We were given this power for a reason, Master. I don't want to lose anyone. I don't want to die. But if my death can change a nation, if I can save thousands, how could I not risk it?
You damn fool. You realize even if all your assumptions are correct, even then, You still have to steal the world's most coveted sword from the world's safest place, then be pursued by the ultimate hunter until you reach the heart of an enemy country in the middle of a war in which any side will happily kill you as a traitor, a spy, a witch, or all three?
I thought you'd like it.
The wolf is gonna have puppies.
Well, I'm hoping not to see him anytime soon. But I figured if I could convince you, then there wouldn't be much he could do about it.
Convince me of what?
To help.
Oh, no. Count me out.
You can't!
I can. Kid, you took away my immortality. That gave me back my life.
You owe me!
Not like this, I don't. I have one life left. One. Because of you, I can do with it whatever I want. I can love.
And Kyla couldn't.
But we can change the world!
Kid, do you know how many times I've changed the world? The Tlaxini Maelstrom used to be a shipping lane. The Aletheran Empire stretched from coast to coast. God kings have threatened the Southlands and nearly gained Kakari half a dozen times. Look, the fact is, I've done my piece. Adventures are for the young, and I'm young by no measure. There's a woman I love in Cenaria, and neither of us is getting younger. I need to go.
I need you! Alone, trying to steal the world's most coveted sword from the world's safest place and being pursued by the perfect hunter into a war.
Yes, yes. I've showed you most of my tricks.
Most of them?
And you've developed a few of your own. You're not an apprentice anymore, Kyla.
Fine, but I'm hardly...
You are a master. Your tutelage is finished.
Don't cut me loose.
I'm cutting you free.
But you're still better than me.
And I always will be. In your memories. I'm smart enough to stop fighting you before you start winning. I reached the top of my game, and I had a good run. From here, I'll only get worse.
But you still have so much to teach me.
You think this isn't going to teach you something?
What if I fail?
What if you do? It won't change how I feel about you.
But I could doom the world. Don't you care?
If I spend my last hours in Gwyn's arms, frankly, not much. Growing old with the woman I love would be my first choice, but dying reconciled with her isn't a bad second.
So I'm alone?
I told you that was the cost when you demanded to be my apprentice.
I didn't know I was agreeing to eternity.
Oh, cry me a river, you're pathetic. What's your plan for getting into the wood?
The Kakari.
The Kakari.
It absorbs magic, eludes magic, makes me invisible. I'll figure something out.
Whose wood is this again? Oh, yeah, Ezra's. And who made the Kakari? Oh, don't tell me. Ezra.
Ezra didn't make the black.
He understood it well enough to make 6 others. So tell me, 50 years after making 6 Kakari, he comes here. And at this point, he and I aren't on such good terms. And he makes himself a fortress. You think it never occurred to him that I might try to come in? Kid, you can scare a few sisters with raw power and bravado, but you're playing on a different plane here. If you live through Ezra's defenses, which, by the way, you strengthen tenfold by throwing Kurok into the woods, you still have to get around a creature so powerful and so cunning that it may have killed Ezra himself. Unless it is Ezra gone utterly mad. Either way, the hunter isn't going to be impressed by raw magic. Your newfound confidence is inspiringly suicidal.
I won't be stopped.
Shut up, she comes.
Kara rolled the Kakari into the center of the fire. The flames collapsed into the ball dying instantly, plunging the clearing into darkness. Kara jumped left and Durza rolled right, even as purple magic blazed through the clearing in jagged hands. Kyler extended a hand, and the Kakari leapt into it, flooding him with the energy it had absorbed from the fire. He leapt from tree to tree, sinking black claws into the sides of each, and saw Amaja flailing about herself, suddenly blind. Fires flared around her. She flipped them back and forth wildly like great scythes in her fear. Durzo, on the ground, was beneath the swipes, and Kyler was above them. In moments, the Maja had exhausted her talent, and with no sunlight and no fire to draw from, her magic gutted out. In the sudden darkness, both men moved. Kyla was on her. He flew straight over her head, grabbed fistfuls of cloak and robe as he passed, and used her body weight like a beam to flip himself over and stop, which transferred his momentum to her. She flew backward half a dozen paces and crashed into a tree trunk. Something was rising from deep beneath her skin. It was beer, and it rose as rapidly as a shark striking from the deep, starting at her fingertips, over her hands and wrists, disappearing in a wriggle that made her sleeves tremble up to her neck like a black blush, and then it stopped. Durzo stood behind the tree trunk, his arms wrapped around it, fingers poking into two points on the side of the Maja's neck. She shrieked as the beer bulged against the blockage like a river at flood assailing a levee. Then, the beer receded, faded, and sank beneath her skin once more. Durzo stepped from behind the tree and grabbed her by the scruff on her neck. Holding her before him, he buried his fingers in those points on her neck again.
A trick you didn't teach me?
You expect me to teach you all I know in a couple of months? The beer needs a physical expression. Block the physical expression, and you block the magical. It's a weakness of the Ursul family's hidden veer.
She's an Ursul?
What better use for Garoth's talented daughter?
I thought he had them killed.
Garoth wasn't a man to throw away tools, no matter how blunt. What's your name, sweetie?
She didn't answer, so Kyler did for her.
It's Eris Buell, you little bitch. We had our suspicions about you.
Not enough to save your precious wife!
In her eyes rose such hatred that Kyler felt his gift unfolding, saw the murders littering Eris's path to power. But there was no dead Aline, nor V. He saw betrayals, broken vows, and, far down on the list, receiving Kyler's sword from a thief and then delivering the blade to Neff's spies.
Justice has been denied you too long!
His dagger punched through Eris's solar plexus.
Damn it! We need to question her, you fool!
Durzo grabbed Eris by her hair, holding her upright.
The Kokari, Kyler. Give me the Kokari, quick!
Kyler handed it to his master. The bastard had nearly torn off his jaw. Kyler put a hand to his face and took it off, sticky. Kyler looked at his fingers. It wasn't blood. Durzo dropped Eris's body. Kyler rubbed the golden liquid between his fingers.
Peri and Xanthos?
It was a contact poison. And though it would only leave him unconscious, the tincture still left permanent scarring.
On my face?
You deserve a permanent slap, Brent. But you heal too well.
Why?
I needed this.
Durzo lifted the Kokari.
Sweet dreams.
Neff Dada strode through the dark streets of Treathel. It was nearly noon, but he was inside the dome of Black Barrel, and the solid black rock dome above him cast the hidden city in perpetual darkness. He could only see his way by the bobbing yellow light hovering over his head, and by the thousands of torches his Verdmeisters had burning around the monolith at the covered city's heart. Despite the darkness, Treathel was an almost cheerful place. It had the air of a city whose inhabitants had stepped out and would be back momentarily. There was no dust, and the siege that had seen the city's death hadn't lasted long enough to destroy its beauty. Sections of the city were scorched and blackened or even leveled by magic, but many were pristine. Perhaps, though, the cheerfulness was all Neff's. His fortunes had changed radically since winter began. He'd sent his thief to steal Kyler's sword, expecting to find that it was covered with the black Kokari. As soon as he'd touched it with magic, he'd known it wasn't the Kokari. It was something better. The sword was Ayers, the Staff of Law. Like Kurok, Ayers had been made by Ezra, or perhaps by Ezra and Jorsen together. Unlike Kurok, Ayers didn't amplify power, but it made vastly complicated weaves 100 times easier to make or unmake. The cylindrical monolith was halfway up the hill to Treathel Castle, extending up to the dome like a glass pillar. In the light of the torches, the monolith looked like a jar of churning smoke. The smoke betrayed only hints of the Titan imprisoned within. Here, a claw pressed against the glass. There, the side of a gigantic, disturbingly human-looking foot. It irritated Neff that he still felt a tremor at the sight of the frozen monster. With Ayers, he could destroy the monolith in an instant. After all, Ezra the Mad had used Eurus to create the monolith, trapping the Titan until Jorsen Alkestes had killed it. The glassy prison of frozen air was broken only by the Titan's death wound. Jorsen had unleashed a bar of fire from the top of Traethel Castle. It had burned through the prison and the Titan's chest in a perfect circle 10 feet in diameter. The raw amount of magic necessary for such a thing made Neff hope Jorsen had been using Kurok. Neff approached the monolith with small steps. His coughs were now mostly out of habit rather than necessity. Ayers was doing wonders for Neff's health. The Verdmeisters nearby made their obeisance and then returned to their work at his wave. Standing on scaffolding, they were lifting buckets of earth and packing it into the hole Jorsen had burned in the Titan. Soon, that earth would be made into flesh, and the Titan would rise. It would break open the great dome of Black Barrow, and then it would break any army that faced Neff. Neff's tent was undisturbed. The 50 soul-sworn guards and his spells guaranteed that. Neff paused inside before entering Kali's room. Hiking up his robe, he touched his silver staff, the form he had chosen for Ayers, and touched it to his ankle. It dissolved from his hand and wrapped smoothly around his ankle and calf. He willed it to be hidden, to remain inert, even if touched with Kali's magic, to simply record all the magic that occurred around it. Kali didn't know about Ayers, and Neff didn't intend for her to find out until it was too late. Ayers changed everything. Composing himself, Neff pulled back the flap. Tensor was sprawled on as fine a bed as they'd been able to make, his limbs loose, features slack, breath slow, eyes open but unfocused and rarely blinking. Neff pretended difficulty kneeling at Tensor's feet and extended the magic as Kali had taught him.
Holy One, I am here to serve.
Tensor's eyes closed, then opened again, and she was present. Her presence filled the little tent like a sooty cloud, making it hard to breathe.
You have been neglecting your duties. This host has bed sores. I will attend to it personally, immediately. I've been about your business, collecting specimens for you. I was hoping we could talk about my reward.
Neff thought that the laughter was amused. It was hard to tell because though Kali controlled Tensor's voice and eyes, she didn't control his facial expressions. They remained blank, slack except when tongue and jaw worked to make words. Kali wanted to be truly embodied, not the rude parody of it she had in Tensor. She needed three things. Ezra's weaves on Black Barrow to be broken, a willing host, and a spell that would require the blood of an Ursul and the combined might of Neff's 200 Verdmeisters. God kings in the past had delivered two of the three, but none could dismantle Ezra's work, because Ezra had used Ayers to deny Kali embodiment. But Neff could undo Ezra's spells, because Ayers remembered every weave it had ever helped make.
I want two things. God King Wanhope will arrive soon to kill me. I want to deny him the use of the Veer. Second, I want to live another 100 years. Impossible! 50 then, 40.
Once embodied, I can give you 100 years, but I can't deny Dorian the Veer.
Neff's heart sank. Dorian was God King Wanhope? Of all Garath Orsul's sons, the last one Neff wished to face was his old pupil.
I thought you controlled...
I do. The Veer are magical parasites. Most of them were wiped out in antiquity. But Rhoygarus Ursul captured several. What he liked about Veer was that in the early part of an infestation, they broke open new channels in their host's talent, adding to the host's power. Of course, they slowly devour their host's talent itself. but Roy Garrus hoped to keep the Veer in that first stage indefinitely. He failed until I helped him. We slowed the progress of an infestation, but they can't be stopped. Try to use your talent. You'll see it's a shadow of what it was when you were young. But I taught Roy Garrus something far more important. The Veer is like a grove of aspens. Each one looks like a separate tree, but they're one organism. Control the right part, and you control the Veer of everyone who's been infected with that strain. Your Veer, Dorians, Garroths, every Kaladorans, they are all one. Roy Garrus and I made a grand bargain. His bloodline would control the Veer, and I would control the reservoir of magic. The vow was made in a way that breaking it will destroy the Veer and the reservoir.
Neff had expected her to lie. He hadn't known the details, but just holding Ayers had made much of Kali's magic plain to him.
If I can't stop him from taking the Veer from me, Dorian will kill me.
When I am embodied, I shall protect you. Your service will not be forgotten. This I swear.
Neff wondered about that. Did Kali really need to be embodied to protect him from a mere man? Was she not a goddess? Or was it simply that she wouldn't protect him because if he wouldn't help her, she had no reason to help him? He wondered what Kali would do to the world if she were embodied. Would she wreak havoc on everything simply because she hated life as all the strangers did? Or was her thirst for power more nuanced? Neff's interactions with her had been as infrequent as he could afford, but he hadn't sensed the same all-encompassing rage from her that he had seen in the other strangers. It was vital to judge correctly. Neff wanted to be God King, but he wanted to rule over more than ashes and the dead. Still, he might not have much choice. If, by not raising her, he would certainly die. But, by raising her, all the world might die. He would risk the world.
I am an old man. I have not the strength for this task.
Tensor Ursul's arm flopped up as if lifted on strings, his hand limp. Neff touched the extended hand, and Kali's magic flowed into him, invigorating him, setting cool fire to his lungs, and it faded. He felt stronger than he had in years, and Ayers had recorded every detail both of the healing and of how Kali herself drew from the reservoir of magic. It might be enough.
Thank you, Holy One.
Neff had only days to figure out the magic necessary, but with Ayers in hand, he might depose more than Dorian.
The latest ones approach. Bring them in.
Neff went outside and gestured to the Soul Swarm. There were 6 young women chained together standing with them, and they all looked terrified. Kali's potential hosts were all peasant girls. Neff's men hadn't had much to choose from in this wilderness. Neff led them inside. They were surprised that the goddess was a drooling young man. Perhaps they'd expected claws and fangs. Neff studied the girls as they studied Kali. 4 were either ugly or plain. Kali hated ugliness. 2 were pretty, but Neff could see that one had been raped against Neff's explicit orders. He would kill someone for that. Kali wanted any violation of her host to come at her own hands. The other girl was even prettier, with big brown eyes and radiant skin, but she was disfigured with scars.
What's your name, child?
Eileen Cromwell. Mistress.
Would you like to live forever, Eileen?
The girl's big eyes filled with such longing that even Neff couldn't help but pity her.
More than anything.
Fear was standing at a table in Ezra's secret workroom under Black Barrow with a polishing cloth in his hand. He wasn't polishing the blade. He'd polished it a dozen times already, and it didn't need polishing in the first place.
It's finished. Except for one thing.
Fear unveiled the sword. His fraud was nearly Coracalestus' twin. He had held Coracalestus, had marveled at it, had studied every whirl in the patterns of the Mysteril. The heads of twin dragons were etched in either side of his blade, facing the tip, dragons of sun and moon in accordance with Curran mythology. The blade had a single edge, curving slightly to give it more cutting surface. The thicker spine of the blade was to give it strength, the flexible iron core compensating for the sharp, hard fragility of the steel edge. This blade's form was pure show. It was mysterious. And it wouldn't break even if a man stood on the side of the blade and the wielder lifted it. Despite its incredible strength, Coracalestus was lighter than it should have been. The Mysteril, folded and refolded like steel, had the same steel patterns Coracalestus' blade had borne. The difference between the original and Fear's fraud was that the original held the fires of heaven. In response to danger or magic or its wielder's mood, the dragons could breathe what looked like fire out to the tip of the blade. Fear knew the weaves to duplicate that now. What he didn't have was a heartstone to hold the weaves. Certain stones resonated with different frequencies of magic. A ruby resonated with fire magics, specifically those having to do with red and orange light. If a stone was pure enough and exactly the right size, which varied by weave, a resonance could be built that sustained itself. This was nearly always imperfect, which was one reason magic imbued in items failed after a time. Fear needed as perfect a ruby as possible to be the dragon's heart.
This part was supposed to be simple. The prophecy was, the greatest red gives dragons heart and head.
The greatest red had to be a big ruby, a heartstone, but placed at the dragon's head on the sword. Fear had done a dozen impossible things over the course of the winter. With the barest of clues he'd been given in his time in Ezra's wood, he'd come to Black Barrow and found the secret tunnel to this room. He'd found the magically hardened gold tools. He'd avoided the hundreds of Verdmeisters who shared the shadowed city with him and found seven broken Mysteril swords. He'd discovered Ezra's notes, a treasure any maker would give his right arm to read. By all the gods, Fear had learned to reforge Mysteril. He'd made the most beautiful fraud in history. But he couldn't find a red rock.
Could any other smith now living make this?
Fear shrugged. Antoninus waited. Fear gave in.
No.
Antoninus picked up the blade reverently, and in spite of himself, Fear was warmed. Antoninus wasn't a maker himself, but he appreciated the mastery required for what Fear had done. He turned the blade over, examining it.
I thought you put your crossed warhammers on it.
In a moment of vanity, well, 2 hours of vanity, Fear had etched his smith mark near the hilt. As a boy, he'd loved the stories about Orin Raisin, one of Jorson's champions. Fear had been the only person he knew who could even think of wielding 2 warhammers as Orin had. Later, he'd mostly given it up. It was a lot easier to find someone to train you with swords.
It's not much of a forgery if you put your name on it. It's still there, but you have to know how to uncover it.
You should be proud, Fear. You've made a thing of beauty.
Without the dragon's heart, I've made nothing.
What troubles you, my king? You've been fondling that rock for 2 days.
Solon pulled Katie into his lap and cupped her breast.
Only when you don't let me fondle better things.
Oh, you beast! I'm serious!
The first days of their marriage had been bliss, except for the rock. Katie's repentance at ordering him to subdue the Takedas by himself had led her to make all the wedding preparations. The very night Solon had arrived, they had been married. Katie refused to wait until later in the spring when the outlying nobles could attend. She said if they were offended, she would threaten to send her Stormrider to visit their isles. but there were only so many hours a day that could be absorbed with lovemaking, though Solon and Katie were doing their best, and that left Solon with time to consider the rock.
I told you a little about my friend Dorian and his prophecy over me.
Something about killing your brother and a kingdom falling, right?
There's nothing quite as infuriating as having a man in a trance lay out your future in a sing-song. Storm riving, storm riding, by your word or silence, a brother king lies dead. Two fears deriding, hope and death colliding, of the sword's man, regal third, true lies in your dragon's heart or head. The North broken and remade on your single word.
Well, you got the storm riding part.
And before you ask, no, I didn't name myself that. I used to have no idea about the rest of it, except the brother king part. If I came home, I would have rallied the nobles to stop my brother, Sir Juron. Thus my words would have left him dead. As it was, I served a man named Regnus Geyer, a man who would have been king and was like a brother to me. I didn't tell him I was a mage, and on learning it, he barred me from his company and was slain. The last part never made any sense to me. I only saw one king in the first part of the prophecy, my brother, so I thought Dorian was raving.
But something has changed.
This ruby, Katie, I never heard of it. My father never spoke of it. Nothing is written about it in the royal records except to record its being in the treasury for at least 200 years. It's listed as the dragon's heart. I think a third king, the regal third, the sword's man, depends on me bringing this ruby to him.
What if you're the third king? What if you're the sword's man? You said it was a sword that turned your hair white. Perhaps a threat approaches here, and you need the ruby to withstand it. Solon, you can't leave. Not on some madman's word.
Two fears deriding. The words were suddenly crystal. Damned prophecies could always be interpreted at least two ways, and usually both were correct.
Katie, there's a garrison called Screaming Winds that guards the pass between Cenaria and Calidor. Dorian and I were there last fall. Dorian was unconscious most of the time, waking and scrawling fragments of prophecy and lapsing into trances again. One day, he woke, screaming. He demanded as much gold as I could get my hands on. I got it for him, and we walked up into the hills to a stunted black oak. Dorian told me that Kali was coming, and that she would tempt him. He said she would massacre everyone. He melted the gold and used it to cover his eyes and ears and made fetters for his arms and legs and asked me to drive stakes pinning him to the black oak. I wrapped him in blankets and left. The commander didn't believe my warnings. I wanted to leave, but I took too long, and I had the men bind me in ropes and I emptied my Glorivirden. But before the men could blindfold me or block my ears, she came.
Kali?
I saw men throwing themselves off the wall. I saw a man tear his eyes out. And then, in a vision I thought was real, I saw you. I tried to go to you, but the ropes saved me. No one else survived. In fact, the Soulsworn came through and made sure everyone was dead. If a body hadn't fallen on me and covered me in blood while I was praying, they would have killed me too.
So to what god should I offer sacrifices for saving your life?
None. It was a coincidence. A lazy soldier who didn't clean the blood from his sword in freezing weather and couldn't draw his sword.
Well, you just so happened to be praying. That's quite some coincidence.
Yes, that's what a coincidence is. Anyway, sorry. When I went to Dorian's Black Oak, he was gone. His tracks led north toward Calidor, but I couldn't follow. I had to see you. Nothing else mattered. I signed on with the captain whose last run of the year was to Hokai.
So this is why you believe Dorian's prophecies?
This is the dragon's heart, Katie. I'm the second king. A third king lives or dies by what I do with this.
What are the two fears?
My fear of Kali and my fear of speaking the truth. The latter was the fear that cost Regnus his life. I feel like I've been given a second chance. First, to speak honestly with you, and second, to face Kali again. Broken North, broken you, remade if you speak one word. I've still got something broken inside, Katie. I thought marrying you would fix it, and I can't tell you how happy I've been and how much I want to stay here forever. But there's a part of me that still whispers, coward.
Coward? You're Solon Stormrider. You braved the winter seas. You put down a rebellion single-handedly. You resisted a goddess. How are you a coward?
Dorian needed me when he went into Kalador. He's probably dead because I didn't go. Regnus is dead because I wouldn't risk telling him who I was. If the prophecy is true, there's a word I have to speak, a life I can save, and I can be remade.
Will it be enough? Will there not be ever one more thing you need to do to prove that voice wrong? Will you chase valor until it kills you?
I've already done the hardest part. I've told you the truth. I won't go unless you give me your blessing. My loyalty is all to you, Katie.
My love, I won't give your death my blessing.
Solon held her gaze for a long time. Then he tossed the heart of the dragon aside.
Then I stay.
Katie pivoted, sitting astride him. She put her hands on both sides of his face and looked deep into his eyes.
Please don't ask again. Please.
I don't know if I should have married you. I think I made a mistake.
They were sitting together in the enormous God King's carriage, slowly rumbling toward a black barrel. Despite the dangers of bringing her to a battle, Dorian hadn't been able to leave Janine behind. Some plot might unfold in Kaliras that would take her from him. And if he had another episode, she was the only person he trusted to cover for him.
But you love me. I know you do.
I do. I respect you and I enjoy your company and I think you're brilliant and honorable. You're a great man.
But
it's not like it was with Logan. I know it's not fair to compare you to a man who's dead. Maybe I just remember all the good things about him now that he's gone, and I know. Maybe it isn't fair to expect love to be the same every time. Maybe with Logan I fell in love the way a girl falls in love, and a woman's love grows slowly and protects itself. I don't know what it's supposed to be like, Dorian, but sometimes I feel so empty. Maybe I should have waited.
I'm a fraud.
But what could he do? Tell her the truth? Send her back to Sonaria and her infatuation for some pretty princeling she didn't even know? Together they were changing a kingdom, bringing light to a dark land. What could Logan give her compared to that? Why should Logan's love be more deserving than his? Janine's love was growing. Dorian knew it. It would grow more still when she realized she was pregnant with their child. He knew it. He'd seen that in his moments of madness on the battlefield and hadn't trusted it or anything else he'd seen there. But in the days since then, he'd looked at her again, and he was sure it was true. Not twins, as he'd first foreseen, but a child, a son. Maybe the twins were to be their next children. He'd been waiting for the right time to tell her the news, but no time had seemed right. He still spent as much of his days with her as he could. Their lovemaking was less frequent now that he was using his harem, but whatever jealousy she might feel seemed outweighed by the sudden reversal of the concubine's feeling toward her. Dorian had given her the credit for preserving their lives. That generosity cracked their envy and hatred. Instead of defeated rivals, Janine suddenly had sisters, and her isolation melted with the spring snow. This was real. It wasn't perfect, but it was the best they could do. This was what it was to be God King. Besides, if he and Janine simply ran away, one of the Verdmeisters would rule with even more brutality than Dorian's father had. Every relationship, every marriage, had its little lies. He was king. A king made choices for other people based on information they didn't have. That was the burden of rule. Dorian had weighed Janine's choices, and he'd chosen.
I'm sorry for laying this at your feet when you've got so many other concerns, but I promised myself when we married that I'd never lie to you, and silence was starting to feel like a lie. I'm sorry. I made my decision. I did marry you. I do love you. It's just hard to be an adult all the time. You've trusted me to be your queen, and I still keep acting like a little girl. I'm sorry for being such a disappointment.
A disappointment? You've done better than I could have imagined. I didn't even begin acting like an adult until I was much older than you are. I'm so proud of you, Janine. I love you more than anything. I understand you're confused. This is a confusing place. I understand you have doubts. We've been married for 2 months, and you've realized that you're committed to something for the rest of your life. And that's scary. Yes. Yes, it hurts me a little. But our love is big enough to take a few scratches. Thanks for telling me the truth. Come here.
They hugged, and he felt her unreserved relief. He wished she would feel his hesitation, wished she would ask him what was wrong. If she asked, he would tell her about Logan. He would tell her everything. After a few more seconds, she released him. He let her go, and the moment passed.
I love you, Dorian.
I love you too, Janine.
Kyler opened his eyes slowly. His mouth felt like it was stuffed with cotton. His whole body was a chorus of complaints from sleeping propped against a tree. Working his jaw to clear the cotton feeling, he sat up. He touched his cheek where Durzo had smeared the poison. The new skin was tender, but there would be no scarring. Durzo was right. The bastard was always right. It was dawn in the woods. Kyler was about to curse aloud when he became aware of a presence in the woods. Kyler willed his senses to come alive. There were no animals in the forest this morning. But whether all the birds had migrated and the squirrels were hibernating, or if the reason was more sinister, Kyler didn't know. He slowly flexed the muscles in his legs and back, judging whether they would cramp if he tried sudden movement. He scanned the forest, turning his head slowly. There was nothing in the forest. No sounds out of place. He thought he could trust his body to respond. Something had woken him. Kyler was sure of it. Instinctively, he reached for the Kakari to cloak himself in invisibility, but the Kakari was gone. Kyler reached instead into his sleeves, loosening the daggers there. He scanned the trees.
Boo.
Kyler threw himself to the side as he buried a knife in the tree above his head. He rolled once, threw himself to his feet, and jumped backward a good 10 paces, daggers in his hands.
I always did like watching you jump.
Durzo was clinging like a spider to the tree Kyler had slept against.
You bastard. Where's the Kakari? What have you done? Give me the Kakari.
All in good time.
Wait. Why am I asking? I can just...
Kyler extended his hand to call the Kakari to him.
Don't!
Kyler stopped.
The hunt is nocturnal. Its sense of smell is better than any tracking dog. Its hearing is acute, and its vision rivals an eagle's, even when it's running full speed. If I time things right, you'll have until dark before it starts hunting you.
What?
Releasing one hand from where it gripped the oak, Durzo unlimbered a black sword from his back. He tossed it to Kyler.
Whatever you do, don't take the Kakari off Kurok. Everything magical that goes into the wood is marked. It's given a scent. So if it's taken out of the wood, the hunter can find it. The Kakari can mask that scent, but I couldn't figure out how to erase it with the time I had. So the second you take the Kakari off Kurok, the hunter will come. I don't know exactly how fast the hunter is, but if you really need to use Kurok, take the Kakari off, use it, and then get the hell away from it. It might be minutes, it might be hours, but the hunter will come. It will risk everything to get this sword.
Durzo had saved Kyler's life again. Kyler had known that his chances of making it into Ezra's wood were dismal, and his odds of stealing Kurok and making it back out were even worse. Durzo had known it too. In his typical way, Durzo wouldn't say anything to tell Kyler what he meant to him, but he'd do anything to show it.
You old bastard.
I can give you magic for the run. If you don't push too hard, you should get there in time and still have energy to fight. I am going to Cenaria. This way, the hunter has to follow us in opposite directions. It should be enough. Don't run flat out like you did when Sister Ariel gave you power. Got it?
Got it.
That was why Durza was clinging to the tree. It made him harder to track. Plus, Kyla suspected the ground had all sorts of traps.
Kyla, the fact Kurok was in the wood tells me Neff's using Iurs to break Jorsen's and Ezra's spells on Black Barrow. It makes Eileen's talk of a Titan plausible. It also means that you're taking the thing he wants most straight to him. If he takes Kurok from you, he could break the world. I don't mean that metaphorically. For 7 centuries, I've done all I could to keep artifacts of such power out of the hands of men and women who will use them unscrupulously. If you fail, he'll undo everything I've spent 7 centuries doing.
You trust me this much?
Come here, you're wasting daylight.
Kyla stepped close.
When Jorsen Alcestis commissioned me for this task, Kyla, he bound me with an oath he claimed was as old as the Night Angels themselves.